Welcome to Still Entitled, the Adam Savage Project. I'm Norm.
I'm Adam.
And I'm Ryan.
Hey, Ryan's back.
Ryan Kaiser.
We're back here for Super Troopers Part 2.
Super Troopers.
It's a story Ryan told last time about how he walked in on one of your Star Wars episode meetings at Mythbusters and said, oh, I love Super Troopers.
You know what the worst part is? I never clarified. I actually meant to say Starship Troopers.
That doesn't make it any better.
It doesn't make it any better, but yeah, that's even the worst part.
Doesn't
this
make
is,
it.
We had a Star Trek bit. Also, your microphone, I can't quite hear you. I think you want to talk into the face of it.
Got it.
Yeah.
There you go.
Look at
the logo. We had a Star Trek bit in the Jamie Hyneman Adam Savage touring show for a while, and my tour manager Gretchen said something about. She didn't say Star Wars. She said, and I'm not sure if she even said Star Trek. But it was like, it was a level of remove from the cultural phenomenon of both Star Wars and Star Trek that was quite impressive.
I knew I liked Gretchen.
And yeah, no. Gretchen lives in Vegas, where all culture comes, and yet some culture totally misses it.
That explains a lot.
Right?
And Star Trek had a life in Vegas. What's Star Trek the Experience? The Las Vegas Hilton.
I've told that story, right?
At the Star Trek
No,
the
about
Experience?
Me going to the Star Trek Experience
no.
sale.
Yes.
Oh, I did not know about this. Oh. So this is, okay, to set up some context, Star Trek the Experience, this is back in the 90s, Star Trek was a big deal. I don't know if people out there, maybe too young millennials, didn't realize Star
Next
Trek was...
Next Generation and all the other ancillary properties that grew out of that in the 90s were just a huge, huge cultural
cover
phenomenon.
Of Time Magazine multiple times. They broadcast on network television the 30th anniversary of Star Trek as a special on TV. Like on CBS or something, in 1998. But it was such a big deal that Hilton Hotels in Las Vegas had developed an attraction. So if you went to the Hilton, and you're from Las Vegas, Ryan,
yeah,
so
it
you
was
know,
quite popular,
right?
It was
yeah,
very, very popular.
And so as a Star Trek fan, I was reading magazines back then, and on BBS's eagerly awaiting the opening of this Star Trek. It was Disneyland for Star Trek.
And there were paid performers who were dressed as Klingons and Starfleet officers and all this kind of stuff. And it was a fully immersive environment with Elkar's displays.
They had two full Enterprise D bridges that they built because they would run these simultaneously with full casts and an emotion simulator ride. And then you could also pay to have like an event. You could get married on the bridge of the Star Trek Enterprise. Like a full immersive experience, not just like a Star Tour type thing.
But, so I'm in Vegas a few years ago, and I can't even remember where the hell we were. I think my wife and I were staying at the Palazzo because I had a corporate appearance there. And my buddy Steve Malero writes to me. Steve is a showrunner for Big Bang Theory. And he's like, dude, you're in Vegas. And I'm like, yeah, I am. And he's like, they're having a garage sale of all the props and costumes from the Star Trek Experience right now.
Oh,
and I'm like, right
God.
Now? And he's like, well, it's 9:30 now, and the garage sale opens at 10 a.m. And I was like, baby, I got to go. So I'm like, I got so excited. And, you know, it's Sunday at 9:30 in the morning in Vegas. Like, that is maybe Vegas's quietest possible time.
It's closer
it's
to
when
find.
It Steven close. Soderbergh shoots his scenes for Ocean's films.
Right. So it's 9:30 in the morning. I jump out of bed. I get on my clothes. I run downstairs. I catch a cab to this address. And you know, Vegas, I drive for half an hour to some warehouse district in the middle of absolute nowhere. This looks like a rejected scene from Breaking Bad is where I've been taking the cab
so sad.
And the cab pulls up out front and I look and there's like 500 people online and I remember at that moment that I'm famous.
Oh.
And everyone turns and is like, oh, cool. And so, I get online and people are really awesome and we start talking about Star Trek. And then the organizers come out. They've heard that I'm in line. So they come out and they say, Mr. Savage, will you join us? And so they bring me in before it opens.
Oh, fantastic.
I didn't know that part.
Oh, yeah. And they show me around.
What do they have?
What they had. I mean, it was like panel displays and Elkar's displays and costumes. I looked at it. I touched a Klingon costume and the woman went, trust me, you don't want to do, you don't want to have anything to do with that costume. And it was like, it's got the DNA and sweat of like 7,000 actors.
And I bet the smell of foam latex.
She was like, you don't even, no, don't even go near those. And the sad part was that the people running the event were really, really awesome, but I did not get the chance to actually buy anything.
Oh.
What would you have wanted from that, do you think?
I feel like I would have wanted some type of, I tell a lie. I actually did buy a little Elkars display, which somehow got lost in some move between shops at some point. But I would have wanted almost like a control panel, like one of the bridge, like one of the smaller bridge control panels, or some device from the background.
Yeah, like the comms panel or navigation, so you can like tell Will Wheaton, I got your panel. Yeah.
What is that thing Spock was always looking in? I want one of those.
Yeah, I don't
the microscope with the glowing blue light.
Because they had built out a full promenade from Deep Space Nine. It was a bar. I remember they had characters walking around pretending to be characters, and it was really sad because they used to have the annual big Star Trek convention at that bar, and then once the Hilton shut down the whole attraction, everything, they put it away in storage, and you'd hear rumors pop up that some developer was going to buy it up and put it in a mall somewhere, or like, you know, Miracle Mile or something, but never happened, and so it all just went away.
I have to admit, even though it's no secret, sci-fi is not my highest on the list. Not my jam. But I definitely actually, I remember going to that a couple times, actually, because whenever people came in town.
Yeah. There was something to take them to.
They had to go. Yeah, had to go. But I never realized that there was two actual bridges.
Yeah.
That makes a lot of sense now.
There's if you search on, it might be on YouTube, but one of the cast members who worked there for many, many years did like a VHS-style documentary series about his time there. It's called Star Trek My Experience, and it has a lot of footage of behind the scenes dressing rooms,
nice.
The people who, what they would, their holiday parties, but it was
half dressed Klingons.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it was just like
Klingon babies.
The bumps aren't only on their heads.
It was just like a, you know, back office, right? Yes. I'm trying to keep it a focus.
Sorry. I am a late convert. I wanted to talk a little bit about television for a second. I'm a late convert to Black Mirror. But I watched White Christmas last night.
Oh,
the John Hamm.
This Black is the holiday special,
the American version, right?
Yeah.
Okay. I didn't realize there were two versions.
Black Mirror did two seasons. It's all run by the same person, and it's British based. So they did two seasons in the UK. I believe it was like three movie length episodes per season. And then, as they do with the UK shows, they did a holiday special, which is like a three-part story. But as they typically, they all tied together at some point.
They did. And so
and then they did an American Netflix release.
Okay, because I remember the original.
I love Black Mirror. I find it slightly uneven. But that Christmas special is among the tightest, most efficient screenwriting I have come across in film or television. Boy, like every thing that show does to communicate to you the world that you're in and how much it doesn't communicate and lets you fill in. Like you arrive and you're in some sort of Antarctic way station that these two guys have been in for 5 years. You understand this from the exposition, and you just fill in like, oh, it's somehow the post-apocalypse and these guys are, it's some sort of penance or prison or something.
And then they tell each other stories.
We'll just go with it. Yeah. And they tell each other stories.
But about their life. Yeah.
Holy cow, the way in which Black Mirror takes an idea and dives really deeply into all the aspects of it that could be messed up is amazing.
Which is why I like the original first two seasons a little more. I know it's trite to say than the US one, because the US one, they released like all these episodes at once. And I think the US one was a little more like, the story is, what if cell phones, but too much? Like, give me a little more depth. And I think the UK ones took some of those ideas a little further. There is one episode, I think it was Emmy Award winning, speaking of Blade Runner, Mackenzie Davis was in San Junipero. So that's the one I would recommend watching from the Netflix US run.
You mean Unipro?
Oh, Unipro.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay.
And that is the beautiful, beautiful episode.
Wow. Okay. And I will totally look it up.
Recently won an Emmy for best like short film series.
The last one I watched last night, it didn't have the best ending, but it was about, you know, we all have cameras in our eyes and a grain installed in our brains. Mm. And there's a couple having sex at one point, and you realize they're actually having sex with each other while replaying other sexual escapades they've had.
Yep.
So it's like if you put on a VR helmet and so did your partner and the two of you did it, but while VR doing it with somebody else or in another time.
Memories of better times.
Yeah.
That's
crazy. Totally. And I mean, that is about as dark as you can get in terms of being disconnected from your reality. Yeah. And the like, you get to see their eyes are sort of glazed over, mm-hmm. like their pupils turn gray when they're doing this. So you first you see them doing it and you realize, oh, I'm looking at their POV of doing it. Then you cut to these two in bed and both their eyes are gray and they're like not actually present with each other. And it's really dark and intense.
I mean, that's intense. We're not going to spoil Blade Runner and talk too much about it because we did an hour of that last week. But a lot of Blade Runner had that kind of feeling of that projecting a future, a fantasy alternate reality. And a lot of that's intentional. And I do want to say one thing we didn't talk about last week is there's an upcoming book.
Yes. Oh, yes, yes.
So it's a lot of these films come out with art books, you know, the making of most or the big, art from.
Most big aesthetically important films have some large coffee table book that comes out with them.
And this one that's coming out for Blade Runner, I don't think it's exactly out yet. They call it specifically The Art and Soul of Blade Runner 2049. And it's not just the art of, but it's really chronicles the journey of how did this film get made. And it's written by, I apologize, I forget her name, but it's the director's
Denis Villeneuve's wife. Yeah, who is a journalist.
It's a journalist. Who's so a writer. It's 100% taken from the journalist's perspective of someone who's embedded in a production and interviewed all the participants throughout and writing it more than just hiring a writer who's a fan and writing captions for photos.
Well, and so as I was saying last week during the spoiler cast, when Ryan Gosling is having his baseline test, the book chronicles how the scene was originally written, how Gosling intersected with that scene and thought, I need something more to understand what's going on, and worked with Villeneuve to deepen that whole scene based on the goal of the scene, based on this. So it's just this wonderful example of the writers, Michael Green and Hampton Fancher, coming up with this really interesting scenario, and the actor Gosling coming in and saying, in order for me to understand what's happening here, I need to modify and deepen this experience, and doing that. So it's this entire, this idea of that a great film like this comes out of a deep collaboration from all corners, from the screenwriters to the talent to the director, all going, oh, we can add this, we can add this, we can add this. And it's the book chronicles that repeatedly throughout the design process, throughout the writing and narrative process.
Got to watch the film, Ryan.
It's so on my list. I should have done it this weekend. I'm really upset with myself.
Well, you're running out of time. Because and this is the part I'm super conflicted about, because I want to see it again in Dolby theaters. But because the film's doing so poorly, it may not be in theaters. They might be pulling it soon. And I want to wait till I get the book and have a chance to dive in the book, read the entire book, and then enjoy it in theaters again.
Well, so I also have another hope about the film, which is I recognize its U.S. opening was softer than they anticipated, $31 million instead of $47. I'm very sad about that. And mostly the reason that I'm sad about that, we might have talked about this last week, is this. It means that movie studios are going to be rightfully more circumspect about blowing $150 million on a movie like this. I understand the reason that they would be. I just feel like it's better for culture overall if there are big, risky bets made like Alcon made on this film. Because the result, even though it might not be a box office smash, is a magnificent addition to the canon of science fiction film and film in general. And it's such an important movie, as far as I'm concerned, that I think it will be nominated for several Oscars. And I hope that the Oscar campaign revivifies and perhaps gives a second theatrical life to this film.
And while we talk about shows like Black Mirror, and I know there's a resurgence in these anthology science fiction shows, Spielberg just signed up to do Amazing Stories for Apple, which could be an anthology show. And also there's the Philip K. Dick Electric Dream series that Bryan Cranston's doing. Those are great, and those are going to expand the horizon for a lot of these stories, but they're not the cinematic experience.
Right.
And something like Blade Runner, it really deserves to be experienced in theaters.
It truly does. And in honestly, Dolby, I swear. So I tweeted yesterday that I thought that the sound of the Dolby version of Blade Runner is intrinsically part of the emotional journey of the film. And I said, I haven't had a film do that in recent memory. And someone pointed out Inception, and they were right. Inception's the sound for Inception is truly amazing.
Yeah. And both Hans Zimmer.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Fascinating.
Yeah.
Now, just to clarify, how many times have you seen the new one now?
I've seen it twice.
It's only twice.
Yes.
Okay.
Three times.
Three times. Okay.
I'm going again.
Okay. Going for three.
All right. I'm going to make this happen this week, just to clarify. Because sure, I'm whatever. Really tired of not knowing what's going on with this movie.
Now, speaking of great movies, I was lucky enough, and I'm allowed to talk about it, luckily. I was lucky enough to go to the wrap party for Coco, the new Pixar film directed by Lee Unkrich. And it is, I'm here to tell you, Coco is amazing. Like, it is an incredible film. I don't want to spoil anything about it. It has to do deeply with Mexican culture and Dia de Muertos, how Mexican culture thinks about their dead and remembers them. It's also deeply about family. Like any good Pixar film, family plays this super important role. And it was hard to see the last half hour through my tears of joy. I'm not kidding. It's one of these, like, so the film's, again, no spoilers. I promise no spoilers at all. I will say that the film sets up things at the beginning where you think, oh, I bet that's going to happen. And it subverts most of the things that you think.
That's good.
And then subverts those again.
Yes.
And so you basically, about halfway through, you're like, I'm just along for the ride. I hope this all works out.
And staying one step ahead.
And it is such a great ride. I've never seen lighting and sets and a subtlety of the distance of this incredible world that they created. This is not Book of Life, another wonderful film that also deals deeply in Mexican culture, produced by Guillermo del Toro. This is not the same plot. It's not a ripoff. They're, you know, completely separate entities. The world premiere opening of Coco will be in Mexico City, if I understand correctly.
What Pixar film do you think this mostly is a sibling to?
Oh, wow.
Visually, thematically.
Oh, my gosh. That's a really great question.
Like, if you like this type of Pixar film, because some people like, they like Incredibles because of its action adventure. And yes, there's family there. But they, or they like, or, you know, Inside Out was wonderful because it's a movie you can really watch with a child growing up.
And it plays on multiple levels. Mm-hmm. Yeah. This one also plays on multiple levels. It is an adventure story. It is a journey inside, right? So there's a lot. There's a little Inside Out. There's a little Bug's Life. Like, this is what the world looks like from this perspective in a way that you didn't expect.
Okay.
It's deeply musical in a way that's really important. And
that's different.
And Michael Giacchino's score is incredible. There's some beautiful songs in it that will wreck you in the best way. It was originally apparently a musical, then scaled back. It still is a little. There's a musical aspect to it, a Hollywood musical aspect to it, but it's not as essentially a musical in terms of songs pushing the plot forward.
Mm-hmm.
But it's really magnificent. And there's so many. I mean, basically, this is a movie you could go see three times and never see the same thing twice. Because you like, you start looking at, oh, the density. Again, the one of the things, the undersung things about Pixar, they get a lot of attention for their character and story because they pay deep attention to that. They get a lot of attention for the look. But when you talk about the look, you're talking about entire teams of people designing sets of surpassing intricacy, and then lighting teams who are writing algorithms about how light moves through these worlds, and the light in these worlds are mind-bendingly lovely. Mm-hmm. So it's I can't gush enough about it. So full disclosure, Lee Unkrich, the director, co-director, is a good friend of mine, and a lot of friends of mine. I have a lot of friends at Pixar, so I've already drunk that Kool-Aid, just so you know.
I think we're all kind of on the Pixar Kool-Aid.
But I'm
still sold.
I'm here to tell you, this is right in line with the best that Pixar has ever produced.
The Kool-Aid is really spiked with my tears.
And there's a lovely thing that they said, that the directors and producers said, that someone said to them was, in this time when there's a lot of talk about building walls, a movie like Coco feels like a bridge.
Oh.
And it's totally true. It really does feel like a bridge between cultures in a way that's really important.
Okay.
Can't wait.
I mean, I have to watch it.
Yeah.
Totally awesome.
I'm
awesome.
Super excited.
Visually, so in terms of the Disney World, somebody did over the weekend, it was a quick shout out. We have in San Francisco the Walt Disney Family Museum, which is, I think it's a hidden gem.
Amazing museum.
It's a great museum if you're a fan of anything related to Disney culture or just history of animation in general. And it's kind of secluded. It's in the Presidio. But they also do special exhibitions. So, you know, the history of like Snow White and Seven Dwarves or Pinocchio. And most recently, one of their what's going ongoing exhibition right now until January is the work of an artist named Ivan Earle. It's a weird, like, old timey 1920 name. Evyvind. But he was the lead concept artist for Sleeping Beauty. So when you think of Sleeping Beauty and all that gothic pastel, like, and all the trees looking very square, that was all him.
Wow.
And it's his entire breadth of work, because he worked until he died in 2000. And I just went to see the exhibit, and it was really breathtaking.
Is it really?
It's amazing. Some of the original cell back, it's not matte paintings, but I guess they're just the cell backgrounds for the layered multi-plane camera for Sleeping Beauty are on display, and it's just wonderful.
Awesome.
Wow. Yeah. And then you mentioned Michael Giacchino.
Yes.
So you'll be doing something with Michael soon.
I am. Right. This will air tomorrow.
Yes. Yes.
So when you're listening to this, it is Tuesday. On this very day, I am getting on a plane and flying to London, where this coming Friday, I will be the MC at Michael Giacchino's 50th birthday party concert at the Royal Albert Hall, featuring a full symphony playing excerpts from Michael's entire canon, from video games through Lost, through Paramount, through Marvel, through every franchise you can think of, Star Trek, Star Wars, Marvel, DC. Michael Giacchino has written the score within that franchise, and I will be helping celebrate this as the MC at his birthday party. Wow.
Is he conducting?
Michael will apparently be conducting at some point, and there'll be a couple of super amazing guest appearances on stage, which I won't spoil, but this is going to be so much fun. A whole bunch of my friends were all heading to London this week to join in the celebration.
That is
going to be pretty amazing.
I
believe there are still a few tickets available. So if you're in London this coming Friday, come on out to the Royal Albert Hall. I have now been lucky enough to sit through three different evenings of symphonic renderings of Michael Giacchino's scores for Lost, for Star Trek, and for something else which now escapes me. There's nothing like hearing a movie score being played by an orchestra live. Holy shit.
Star Wars.
It really, really just puts you into the middle of it. And when you watch... You don't realize, you know, symphony musicians in your head. You're like, oh, symphony musicians, really excellent musicians who go in and do their job and they play music. And I'm like, yeah. Do you realize that most of them, we'll be rehearsing at the Royal Albert Hall, but most of the time for movie scores, these professionals are sitting down with music they've seen right now and then they just play it.
Did not know that.
And they get it right. Like most of the time on the first or second try. And that, when you think about a 95 piece orchestra, is like mind blowing.
That's why the conductor's there.
And to watch them do their thing live is super thrilling.
I mean, I was super skeptical when Hans Zimmer said he was going to headline Coachella. But from every indication, that was a transformative experience for everyone who attended Coachella this past year.
Fascinating. Yeah. So no, I won't say that. Never mind. I had a little tiny spoiler to tell about one of the things we talked about tonight, but I realized I shouldn't.
The fact that there are spoilers makes this a very intriguing event, and I'm envious of everyone who's going to be there in London with you.
I'm really psyched. I also get to see some friends in London, so yeah. I will be I'll be gone about a week, and then we'll be back again and recording another podcast the following week.
Yeah. And I also want to one final shout out. I know Brain Candy is going back on tour in November.
In November, Brain Candy Live. We're doing a 24-city tour starting in early November, I think the 12th, if I'm not incorrect.
Yes.
BrainCandyLive.com. See if we're coming to a city near you. Please come on out. Michael Stevens and I, even if you've seen the show before, and we're not repeating any markets we did this spring, but if we're close to you and you're wondering to come see it again, because we've rejiggered a whole bunch of this show. It's an organic and ongoing process, and we're having so much fun performing it. We performed a little bit of a piece of it on the Kelly Ripa and Ryan Seacrest show, and we'll be performing another piece of it on a late night show in a couple of weeks. This is so much fun for us to do. And if you're wondering whether or not to come on out or bring your kids, it's completely family friendly and you will also laugh your ass off. It plays to both kids and adults.
And it's one of those things that just before we sat down to record this podcast, Ryan and I were privy to some of your experimentation to develop
yes.
things for the show. And it's awesome. It was just incredible to be a fly on the wall to watch you build something and tinker with something that these thousands of people are going to get to see.
Yeah, I'm trying to figure out a way to, you know, dunk a kid's hand into a pot of boiling water. Safely.
Yeah.
These are the kind of things we're trying to work out.
Yeah.
And if how is that going to work out? You're just going to have to come and see how it goes.
Exactly. And if you're in San Francisco, end of next week is yes! the Tested live show. Yes. Saturday, October 28th at the Castro Theater, our fourth annual one.
So, Tested, Deconstructed.
Yeah. And so we're doing lots of builds in the office this week. With the team, something's happening in our studio right now, so we'll hopefully see some of you there.
It's really, I love it when this place, when our co-offices become hives of activity, because you know there's people over in the Makerspace and the Tested offices, and then people drift over here for supplies and advice and ideas, and it just, that feverish intensity of those kind of builds makes me very happy.
Us too.
Yeah.
It's very exciting.
But I guess that does it for this week.
One last thing. I tweeted about this yesterday. There's a young girl who handmade her own Totoro costume from the designs from my one-day build using a lot of the same techniques, and she knocked it out of the park. I tweeted about it yesterday. Just check my Twitter feed because I love this, and I said this. I think the next I'm not sure I'm able to make it to Silicon Valley Comic Con next year because of the spring tour, but definitely I'll be at San Diego Comic Con. And I really want to say this, Studio Ghibli cosplayers, let's have a meetup at San Diego Comic Con. All the Kikis and the Princess Mononokes, all the Totoros, the No Faces, the Cat Buses. I want to have a big Studio Ghibli meetup because, there's so much love for these costumes and for these franchises. Come on,
you can totally... The Wind Rises? A Zero Airplane?
Yeah. So that's just, I'm just putting that out there.
Awesome. And we'll see you next week. Have a safe trip.
Thank you. I will. All right, guys. See you next week.
Bye, guys.
Bye, Mom.
This week's episode of Still Entitled is brought to you by Casper Mattresses. With three mattress models, the original Casper, the Wave, and the Essential, Casper mattresses are perfectly designed to soothe and cradle your natural geometry. Not to mention, the breathable design helps you sleep cool and regulates your body temperature throughout the night. And it's delivered right to your door in a small, how do they do that, size box with free shipping and returns in the US and Canada. And the best part is you can be sure of your purchase with Casper's 100-night risk-free sleep-on-it trial. After all, you spend one-third of your life sleeping, so you should be comfortable. Start sleeping ahead of the curve with Casper. Get $50 toward any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/untitled and using the offer code untitled at checkout. Again, that's casper.com/untitled using the offer code untitled for $50 off your mattress purchase. Terms and conditions apply.